Our next argument will be 17-1185, U.S. v. Evans. Ms. McGarry?
Good morning. I am Kathleen McGarry, and I'm here on behalf of the appellant in this case, Jill Evans. This case presents the court with three interesting questions. What does it mean to vary from the guidelines? What's the time frame that's important in determining acceptance of responsibility and whether it should be applied? And is the length of the sentence in this case unreasonable based on the court's analysis? The court announced up front when the sentencing hearing started in this case that he was not going to follow the guidelines. He was going to vary from the guidelines. But what does it mean to vary from the guidelines? In reviewing cases that talk about variances, starting with Gall versus United States, it would seem that when the court talks about a variance, they're talking about something that is either below or above what sentencing guidelines would be.
Well, let's put that in context, though. Here, hadn't counsel for Ms. Evans argued that the guidelines for white-collar crime were inappropriate, not good? Hadn't there been that argument?
He certainly did argue, Your Honor, that they were overinflated, I guess, and that they were probably not appropriate. And actually, it's interesting because the defense counsel in this case actually filed a motion for variance. And if you start reading through the transcript, the court actually grants the motion. And I'm sure defense counsel is sitting there going, yay, I'm going to get a below the sentence guidelines because he's going to vary. But what ended up happening was
So what the judge was saying, wasn't it? He's saying, I don't like these guidelines. I don't think this is the appropriate way to measure the sentence for white-collar crime of this sort. But the judge went ahead and computed the guidelines, as you're required to do, and then decided, I don't like these guidelines, which he can do, and then imposed a sentence and explained the sentence under 3553. I have a hard time seeing what the problem is.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the problem is, I think you touched on it in some of your comments there, is that I don't think he likes the guidelines.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty clear. And he actually says he varies, and whether he truly varies or whether he's just throwing the guidelines out in half of the cases, I don't know. I didn't go back and research all of his decisions, but he certainly said in half of the cases he doesn't follow the guidelines.
Did he say in half the cases he doesn't?
Yes, he did. And so I guess the question would probably be, first thing that comes to mind is, if all the district court judges did that, why do we even need the guidelines? If the guidelines don't serve a purpose, then why do we have them if they're going to be discarded in half the cases every district court judge reviews? And in this case, I almost get the sense that he didn't want to deal with the guidelines because he didn't, one of the big issues in this case is acceptance of responsibility. It makes a huge difference to Ms. Evans. If the court gives her the 3 points for acceptance of responsibility, it takes her sentencing range down.
But he did deal with it.
He dealt it with he said, it matters not. It matters not what I think about acceptance of responsibility.
But he also said, you're not entitled to it because even if you pleaded, you continued to engage in this conduct. And that, to him, meant you're not accepting responsibility for your misdeeds. And what more could he have done? Well, I'm sure he could do a lot more. Why isn't that enough? And maybe he's wrong, and you can argue that that's not an appropriate way to dispose of it. But he didn't avoid any of his responsibilities under the guidelines. He calculated the guidelines. He made a ruling on each of the provisions that was required. I don't think he's being lazy in the least in this case.
I guess that, if you look at what Gall requires, and it says he needs to correctly calculate the guidelines, and I agree, he did calculate them without the addition of the acceptance of responsibility included in or subtracted from the from the range. But then he needs to really, he needs to look at the departures, that any departures, and it seems the judge, you're thinking that maybe he did do that by just saying that he wasn't going to apply acceptance. Acceptance was very big in this case. This wasn't just a case in which, you kind of hoped maybe you'd get the acceptance of responsibility. We had the government advocating for acceptance of responsibility in this case.
You found an independent judge, didn't you?
We did find that. I mean, there was an independent judge. But I think if the judge is going to discount the acceptance of responsibility, which the government himself said that he thought that that she had adhered to the plea bargain, and this was a very extensive plea bargain in this case. I mean, it saved the government an incredible amount of time and money to not have to try this case. And in return, she kind of thought she was going to get this acceptance of responsibility. When the judge talks about it, it seems as if the judge is relying on a lot more than what happened in that window between when she entered the plea on January 23rd of 2017 and when she was sentenced on May of 2017. And a lot of the things that, I mean, even the PS, the government acknowledges, the trial counsel for the government acknowledged that the behavior that led the PSR or PSI writer to not include acceptance happened after the indictment, but before she actually came into court and said, I'm changing my plea, I'm going to plead guilty, here's what I did. I have this extensive statement of why I'm entering the plea and what she did between those windows from January to February, I don't think supports the judge's decision not to give her.
January to May.
I'm sorry, January to May. Supports the judge's decision not to give her those 3 points.
Okay.
I mean, and he actually even goes on to say that, a little bit later in the transcript, he comes back to acceptance and he says that, all of her reasons for being evasive and not being honest or whatever support not giving her probation. Well, that wasn't what was being asked. I mean, yes, the defense counsel was asking for 33 months, but the government was asking for 57. So, I mean, there's nobody really, probation was kind of out there as an option, but it wasn't something that was ever seriously considered, I don't believe.
Let me ask you on the acceptance of responsibility. Is it irrational for a court to say the defendant did not accept responsibility for her prior misconduct because she continued to engage in the same sort of misconduct even after she pleaded? Is that reversible error to make that determination, or is it something else that's wrong?
I'm not sure what the something else would be, but I think that if the record doesn't support it, I think it is wrong for him to make that statement. And then I think, the next step would be...
So is that your point, that the record doesn't support that she continued to...
Yes, that is my point, is that the record does not support it. I mean, the record certainly is filled with a lot of Ms. Evans' misdeeds. And there were a lot in state court and in federal court. But if the window that we're looking at is January of 2017 to May of 2017, I think she should get it. I think that what he cites to is not telling her landlord something. I'm not sure that's enough to deny somebody a 3-point reduction or supports this idea that she was continuing in the same kind of behavior that she had engaged in prior to entering her guilty plea. What I believe that we've been arguing so far about has been mostly the idea that the judge was procedurally unreasonable in varying from the sentencing guidelines, which he actually really didn't because he imposed a sentence that came within the guideline range. I believe that at that point that if he's going to vary from the guidelines and ignore the guidelines, then he is not entitled to the presumption that appellate courts would give him. I mean, I think
okay,
at that point...
Fine. But he did explain his sentence at the sentencing. Was that inadequate? It seemed to me he went through the factors pretty thoroughly.
He went through the factors, but again, I don't believe, based on the record in this case, that his reasoning... I mean, I'm kind of jumping into the substantive argument as well, that the reasoning that he gave along the way supports his decision. So he, again, says that he's going to, and he has to look at the 3553 factors, whether he follows the guidelines or whether he doesn't follow them. Those are things that have to be followed.
But we require a fuller explanation if it's not within guideline sentence, and the point you make makes sense to me that ordinarily if it's a within guideline sentence, then there's a presumption of reasonability. But if the judge says, I'm not, I'm reaching the sentence independent of what the guidelines tell me, then that presumption makes sense to say that doesn't apply anymore. Let me just
talk about a couple of things, because okay. A couple of the factors that he talked about, for example, you know, he faulted her for not expressing remorse. And the record, and you know, and he says, oh, she just kind of came late to the dance. You know, we're here at the sentencing hearing. This is the first time I've ever heard her say anything about her feeling sorry for the victims. But that's not true. There was independent sources that... In the doctor's report, in letters from the family, which talked about her remorse, in the doctor's report, there was a lot of Ms. Evans had mentioned to the doctor how horrible she felt about what had happened. She wished it had never happened.
Was he talking about her own individual expressions of remorse to the court?
Well, actually, he said there was nothing in the plea agreement, and there was nothing in the PSR. But there really wouldn't ever be. I mean, you know, the plea agreement wouldn't include anything that the defendant felt really bad about the case, you know, or wished it hadn't happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and those aren't written by her. Those are written by, you know, the probation officer or the, you know, the two attorneys who wrote the plea agreement when, you know, they didn't put it in there. I don't know that they would have put it in there.
And it doesn't go in the PSR?
I mean, I think if it's probably mentioned, but I mean, I'm not sure that it's required to go in the PSR. I've not seen it in a PSR numerous times that the defendant, a lot of times the defendant doesn't even talk to the probation officer. So in that case, it wouldn't be in the PSR, no matter how bad she felt. He said he looked at the letters from the family members and failed to glean anything, but there was an incredible amount of evidence from a lot of people about which would have given him, because he doesn't just look at the crime, he has to look at the defendant, you know, and there was a lot of information in there talking about what kind of a mom she was, what kind of a person in the community she was, what kind of a wife she was, what kind of a sister she was. So there was information, and the letters also said, you know, I have seen my sister, you know, express remorse for this case. I just think that the when he's going through his 3553 factors, for example, you know what the case law seems to say is that not only do they look at what is the defense asking for, what is the government asking for, how do these factors support the arguments they're making. And the government argued for 57 months, and there's nowhere that he says, where the court explains why 57 months wouldn't have been enough to satisfy, or whether it would have been sufficient to address the sentencing considerations. I'm going to save my last 37 seconds for rebuttal.
Well, I'm looking back here, and I want to mention, you mentioned the report from the doctor, but the court did, I do find where the court addressed that Dr. Bograd's report. He said it wasn't a of great help in many respect because it scarcely mentions her prior offenses and says nothing at all about her silence when it comes to expressing any kind of empathy for the victim. And you're saying that's incorrect, that the Dr. Bograd's report does say something about her expressions of empathy for the victims?
It does, yes. I know it's cited in my brief where I specifically quote from her report where she addresses the remorse that she saw while she was interviewing the defendant. And again, I go back to the, he kind of discounts it because the doctor wasn't talking about her prior offense. Well, she wasn't in front of him on what happened in the Colorado State Court. She was in front of him on the federal charges. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. Michael Johnson for the United States. I'd like to start briefly by just discussing the standard of review here. There are two main issues that are being raised in this case, a procedural unreasonableness claim and also a substantive unreasonableness claim. As to the procedural unreasonableness claim, there are a few parts to that. There's a claim that the district court erred in denying an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility, and also a claim that the district court erred in failing to state reasons in its post-sentencing hearing statement of reasons. And then also this question about whether the district court erred in ruling that the granting the motion for variance, but then issuing it within guideline sentence in this statement of reasons. I'd like to first talk about the adjustment of responsibility decision. We argued in our answer brief that Ms. Evans didn't raise the issue below. She did, in fact, raise the issue before the district court, and we saw that in her reply brief. So because she did raise it, the standard of review of her adjustment of responsibility issue is for clear error, and that's this court's decision from U.S. versus Govan, which is 173 F3rd 798, 10th Circuit decision from 1999. Under that clear error standard, this court will reverse a denial of an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility only if the court is, quote, left with a definite and firm conviction that a mistake has been committed, unquote. And this is from this court's decision from United States versus Battles, which is 745 F3rd 436, a 10th Circuit decision from 2014. She argues that the district court erred in considering post-plea conduct and also in considering some pre-plea conduct. We filed a 28-J letter with the court 2 days ago on January 16, and in that 28-J letter we identified this court's unpublished decision from last month in United States versus Downing, a decision authored by Judge Moritz. And in that decision in Downing, the court also cites its earlier decision from United States versus Prince. And both Downing and Prince stand for the proposition that a district court may consider post-plea conduct in determining whether an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility is appropriate. So we submit that the court properly could consider post-plea conduct.
Was that post-plea conduct that occurred in the period?
The district court relied on some false statements that Ms.
A troublemaker today.
Ms. Evans made some false statements to her landlord. And then Ms. Evans also made some false statements to the probation office regarding the amount of money her sister was paying. And this is at volume 3 of the transcript at pages 125 and 126.
False statements to the landlord about what?
It's not clear exactly what the district court was relying on. The transcript of the sentencing hearing just says that Ms. Evans made false statements to the landlord. We note that
isn't that kind of problematic? How do we review that?
Well,
whether it was clear error.
It's not the government's burden to show clear error. It's Ms. Evans' burden to show clear error.
She says there's no evidence.
She says it's not there. Yeah.
Well, there are statements in to the probation office. There are statements that the probation office identifies in the pre-sentence report. And there are some of those statements the district court could properly rely on. The probation office also indicated in the pre-sentence report that while Ms. Evans was in pretrial, during pretrial, she was employed by a company, and that she was then terminated from the company for falsifying documents. And this is in the record.
And this was post-plea conduct? I'm confused.
It's not clear if it's post-plea conduct or not. This is volume 2 of the PSR, page 44, paragraphs 39 to 40. But this all goes to the question of whether, in fact, Ms. Evans was accepting responsibility for her actions. And the district court could properly consider in its discretion whether or not she was accepting responsibility based on these other actions, and as this court pointed out in Prince,
these other actions, even though they're before the guilty plea,
correct, and also actions that appear to be after the guilty plea, that the district court could properly consider that, consider those actions, and under clear error review, the district court did not clearly err in determining that other actions by Ms. Evans indicated that she was not accepting responsibility for the specific conduct here to which she pled guilty. If there's no other questions on the adjustment of responsibility issue, I'll turn to the other issues. Regarding the variance issue, the district court indicated that it was granting Ms. Evans' motion for a variance. But it said that it was granting the motion because it didn't view the guidelines as properly considering the crime of fraud, and it was therefore the court was not going to follow the guidelines. The district court said that it used the term variance as meaning, quote, that the sentence will not be based upon the guidelines at all. And this is volume 3 of the record at page 8, and the district court then calculated Ms. Evans' guidelines range accurately, and there's no dispute about that, but for the 3-point adjustment for acceptance of responsibility. In Ms. Evans' motion for variance filed to the district court, she acknowledged that the guideline range had been correctly calculated by the district court. The district court's decision to grant the motion for variance is not inconsistent with its later statement of reasons that it filed subsequent to the sentencing hearing, because the district court granted the motion for variance solely on the grounds that it was not going to follow the guidelines. It ultimately did issue a sentence within the guidelines range based solely on the 3553A factors, which it is permitted to do.
So are you saying the court did or didn't grant a variance?
Did
the court apply the guidelines or didn't it? Because it makes a difference with regard to the statement of reasons. This is a pretty hinky deal here. I don't know how. Makes a difference in how we review.
Right, right.
Do you think we owe any deference? Do you think there's a presumption of reasonableness of the sentence in light of the judges saying that he was disregarding the guidelines in determining what the length of the sentence should be?
It's not inappropriate. The guidelines are solely advisory. The court may rely solely on the 3553A factors in issuing a sentence.
I'm sorry, I must not have expressed that correctly. It's fine if he doesn't rely on the guidelines, but if he doesn't rely on the guidelines, we don't presume that a within-guideline sentence within that range is reasonable. He has to explain it in more detail. Don't you agree?
I don't agree, Your Honor. The court here correctly calculated the guidelines range. It concluded that a sentence solely under the 3553A factors was appropriate, That determination also happened to result in a sentence falling within the guidelines. And so that provides an even more of a reason to find that the sentence is appropriate.
Okay, so the judge can say, I'm granting a variance. I'm not biting off on these guidelines. Don't care about the guidelines. But it just so happens that the guideline falls within the range, and so you want us to apply the presumption of reasonableness. I guess I'm not seeing. Is there any authority for that? Of course, this is an unusual circumstance, but I just.
The court in Crystal said that if the sentence is within the correctly calculated guideline range, it's considered presumptively reasonable.
Was that a case where the judge said he wasn't paying any attention to the guidelines?
That is not.
Read those opinions in context, and the context was given the deference given to guidelines or the fact that the guidelines have undergone considerable review by some people, if you say I'm giving a guideline sentence and it's sentences within the guideline range, then we're going to not require further explanation. The explanation it's enough to say I'm going along with the experts who provide the guidelines. Once you say you're not going along with them, it seems to me you have a responsibility, you have a duty to explain your sentence in light of the 3553A factors.
That's exactly right. And Judge Kane did do that in this case.
Okay, well, there was some criticism of that by the counsel, that he based it on ignoring parts of the record, saying that the letters from the family didn't say anything, saying that, I can't remember who else, didn't really say anything, when in fact it did. How do you respond to her criticisms of the court's explanation?
I assume that we're now in the substantive unreasonableness realm rather than
really,
procedural?
No, because procedurally you have to give a more substantial explanation if you're not saying you're relying on the guidelines. The reason you don't have to give an explanation when you say you're relying on the guidelines is because that's your explanation. That's what the experts think. That's what a lot of judges do. That's consistent with statutes and so on. So that's your explanation. You don't have to say very much. When you're rejecting that rationale for your sentence, you need to explain it under 3553. The default position is you have to explain your sentence under 3553. You don't have to do as very much when you've incorporated the guidelines, because that's your explanation. So I think it's part of procedural reasonableness here. It obviously is a similar sort of analysis we go through for substantive reasonableness. But can you respond to her criticism of the judge's explanation?
The judge went through the 3553A factors in detail. This is at pages 123 to 130 of the sentencing hearing, and explained a number of reasons for the sentence that he reached. The record doesn't indicate that the judge improperly discounted certain issues or factors in the case. The district court did, in fact, consider the letters from relatives, that did review the expert report from the psychiatrist. There's no indication that the court did not consider a proper 3553A factor.
That's good, and it is a lengthy explanation. But if it's based on a distorted or false reading of what he says he relies on, then we've got a problem. And that's, I think, the allegation here, is that what the judge said about the psychiatrist and the letters and so on is just a misreading of that information. And if there's a misreading, it's not enough to say the judge considered this.
I don't think the record reflects that it's a misreading. If I could point out quickly,
yes,
this issue should be reviewed. If it's a procedural unreasonableness claim, this issue should be reviewed solely for plain error, because it wasn't raised at the district court, and there's very little argument whatsoever in the reply brief. There's no argument at all in the opening brief, that this issue was raised below. There's no indication that it was raised below. Ms. Evans argues that it could not have been raised below because she was not able to review the statement of reasons until after the sentencing hearing. But at the sentencing hearing where the district court made all of these statements, there was certainly a full opportunity to object at the sentencing hearing to the district court's reasons, and there was no objection at all at the sentencing hearing to the court's reasons for its sentence. And so because it was not raised, it was not objected to at the sentencing hearing, this court's review at most should be for plain error. We submit that it was not argued in the reply, and the issue should be viewed as waived. If it's not viewed as waived, and it's solely reviewed for plain error, we submit there's been no showing of plain error here. No error first, no error that was plain, no indication that Ms. Evans' substantive rights were affected, or that the district court's decision seriously affected the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings. No elements of the four-element plain error test have been met regarding this claim of procedural or unreasonableness. I notice I only have a few seconds left.
It's red.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We asked that they...
Thank you. You guys are making me feel much, much better about my earlier.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You guys. Any questions from other members? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That clock satisfies my rule about the positive animosity of inanimate objects.
Yeah.
The humor was not about this case. It was about,
oh, no, that's
it was
fine,
about
yeah.
that clock.
We all seem to have trouble today.
Share it with everyone.
And my apology for the interjection.
Judge McKay, share that. I think everyone would enjoy this.
I'm just observing to Judge Hart that this verifies my rule about the positive animosity of inanimate objects. I have a whole essay on that.
You are probably right, Your Honor. Since I have such a limited amount of time, I just wanted to address a couple things real quickly.
Her time was? No, I thought she had a few seconds. No? Oh, that's right, because then Judge Moritz is. Go ahead. Give me
30
seconds.
We seem to be having trouble today with these things. Our reply brief addresses the plain error, so I won't go over that. And I would just address one comment made by my opposing counsel, and that's concerning the employment issue, and that occurred prior to her entry of her plea. So that was in 2016.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is submitted. Counsel are excused. We'll turn to our final case, U.S. v. Kahn, 17-80-35. I forgot she did have some time, but then we asked the question. I forgot about that.